Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
John Henry Newman was born on February 21st, 1801. His father was a banker of some means. He read David Hume, like all of you have, at 14 years old. And David Hume's skepticism gripped him in a way that gave an unexpected result. He became an evangelical. So you move from skepticism to a kind of fideism about your faith. Evangelicals tend to be more fideistic. And so he moved from Humean skepticism at 14 to becoming an evangelical at 15. He came early to see, however, that religious affectivity, which is a nice 19th century way of saying the heart is strangely warmed, the evangelical's heart is strangely warmed, religious affectivity and the doctrine of justification by faith alone are actually the flip side of skepticism. Now, that's an interesting thought to come to at 15 years old. Most of you wouldn't come to that. This is what he will later call the principle of Protestantism, which he also sometimes called private judgment, which you probably have heard of if you've read. Right. So the idea of private judgment as the principle of Protestantism goes right to the age of 14, 15, very, very early in his formation. Moving from Humean skepticism to evangelical fideism, he sees that he comes to see that these are two sides of the same coin. And so he goes to Oxford, and in 1825, he becomes an Anglican priest. And he joins together with other like-minded, which is to say other Catholic-minded Anglicans at Oxford. And they form, roughly from 1828 to 1845, what's called the Oxford Movement. And the Oxford Movement is a very heady movement of bringing both the high and low forms of Anglicanism back to the historic Catholic faith, but not through Rome. That was the phrase. They wrote many, many essays in the famous Tracts for the Times. But as Newman proceeded, he began to have, well, I won't say Humean doubts, but he began to have doubts. Doubts especially about that phrase, become Catholic, but not through Rome. That phrase is predicated on what's called branch theory. Branch theory is the idea that Catholicism is really Roman and Anglican and Eastern. It's these branches that flow out. And so you could be Anglican but not through Rome and make sense of that. But he began to have doubts about the Anglican branch theory, which of course perfectly justifies the Church of England, but in Newman's view, doesn't match the history. This is where we begin to see that to be deep in history is to cease to be Protestant. By 1839, he was beginning to see Anglicanism as less than Catholic. That's an innovation in his thinking by 1839. And the way he gets to that is by the Arian controversy. And the Arian controversy is very tumultuous. You think things are tough in the church now with Pope Francis and blah, blah, blah. The Arian controversy was 60, 70 years of total tumult where you had Arians who were bishops of important sees. That is serious division. But in the Arian controversy, Newman tracks what would be the Anglican view. And the Anglican view was the semi-Arian view. And so he comes to say to himself, well, branch theory cannot be true then. Because the Anglican view currently in 1835 or 1839 is the same as the semi-Arian view in the 4th century. Again, what resonates for him is to be deep in history is actually to cease to believe in the branch theory. And if you cease to believe in the branch theory, then you cease to believe that you can be Catholic but not through Rome. Make sense? This is what brings him to the place in which he writes the essay on the development of doctrine as a Protestant, right on the precipice of his conversion. By the time he concludes writing, his essay on the development of doctrine in 1845 at Littlemore, he also concludes that Catholicism is the living principle that he's always been pursuing as a Christian. Catholicism is the living principle. This is going to matter if you see on your handouts, the seventh note is chronic vigor. The faith is, Christianity is like fire. It's something that has chronic vigor. It's alive. And he says, this is what I've been pursuing. Not Anglicanism, but this, Catholicism, has chronic vigor. And so by 1845, he is received into the Catholic Church by Father Dominic Barbieri, October 9th, 1845, if you want to know. And the essay can be read as, in a sense, a record of his intellectual conversion just prior to entering. And I want to read it that way today. In 1878, he produces, this is just a curiosity on the side, in 1878, he does produce a Catholic edition. When he came into the church, he asked the bishops if he could get a nihil obstat, you know, an imprimatur for his book. And they're like, no, that's a book you wrote as an Anglican. You just leave it be. You don't need an imprimatur for that. But in 1878, he was a cardinal. And so he had the power to give his own imprimatur. So he produced a new edition. And most of your editions, if you have a copy of the essay, it'll be the 1878 edition with Cardinal Newman's own imprimatur on his own Protestant essay. Or it's a very Catholic essay, but he was Protestant. The essay stands, I think, almost counterintuitively as something that's not really about development. I read Newman's essay as actually an explication of why we can say what Jude 3 says, which is the faith has been delivered once for all the saints. Right? And so the idea of development, though, is intrinsic to his coming into the church. So I want to pursue this. Before John Henry Newman, development was not a major theme in Catholic theology. You can go back, of course, to St. Vincent of Lauren's Commonatorium. And there you can have something like a standard for adjudicating conflicts. And that is that he writes, let there be growth and abundant progress. This is a 5th century saint. So this is going quite a ways back. St. Vincent of Lauren's 5th century. And he writes in his Commonatorium, let there be growth and abundant progress in understanding. Now that was the dominant view of thinking about changes and how things seemed like they were developing. But what's developing always for St. Vincent of Lauren is the church's understanding of what's been delivered once for all. Progress in understanding, progress in knowledge, and most of all, progress in wisdom. These are the adjudicating terms for progress, right? Not just historical progress, evolution, but progress in virtue, progress in wisdom. In each and all, in individuals and in the whole church, at all times and in the progress of ages, but only with the proper limits, St. Vincent of Lauren writes. That is, what are the limits? With the same dogma, the same meaning, and the same judgment. In 1870, in Dei Filius at Vatican I, also stresses this view of identity, that the faith has always been the same. Does anyone know who Cardinal Ottaviani is? He was like reactionary, like he headed up the Holy Office under Pius XII. He was a big deal. He led the reactionaries at Vatican II. His episcopal motto was semper idem, always the same, right? Always the same. That is precisely the Catholic view of doctrinal development. And I will argue tonight that it is Newman's view of doctrinal development. But you have to go through the development to see it. Indeed, Pope John XXIII began the council with a citation from St. Vincent of Lauren. Did you know that? Towards this idea of always the same, right? The same dogma for all of you anti-conciliarists. He opens the council with that the faith is always one thing, even though it's communicated in various ways, enunciated in various ways. John Henry Newman discovers and elucidates this. He sought to articulate how we can avoid, on the one hand, dogmatic relativism, a kind of historicism which says, well, that was the dogma in the 12th century, but now we have a new dogma in the 21st century. And also how to avoid dogmatic absolutism. Well, we've said it this way, there can be no other way to say it. Newman wanted to avoid also a primitivist view of the church, which he had in mind evangelicals who wanted Bible studies and small groups, little platoons, if you will, of the Bible. And he wanted to, in a sense, show that the primitivist view is not primitive. It's not, in a sense, part of the historic deposit. That the whole deposit of faith was clearly and completely understood from the beginning, was Newman's view. Was the primitivist view was that the deposit of faith was understood completely from the beginning and then became less clear over time. And he says the opposite is the case, right? That actually the whole of the faith was delivered once for all and gained increasing levels of clarity, right? That's why it's completely like, sorry if I offend your senses, but there's an argument that you should receive on the hand because there were early Christian communities that received in the hand. But Newman would say, well, then at some point the church developed and became clear in its idea, and a better Augustinian view was to receive on the tongue so that you're passive and receptive when you receive the Most Holy Eucharist. In a sense, those who argued for reception in the hand, see, I told somebody, if you get me on a digression, I'll take up too much time. But you're thinking about it all wrong, actually, that the church learns and understands more about the deposit of faith. These are not doctrinal accretions, but rather articulations. He charts a Vincentian middle way which maintains always the same dogma, the same meaning, the same judgment, so that what Christians say in the 4th century is the same as what we say in the 21st century. This is always then to be understood as an idea of growth in our understanding, not growth in the faith, right? Newman's idea of development does bear some marks of 19th century thought, however. He's not a timeless thinker. In this respect, even when I talk about growth, that is a theme of Romanticism in the 19th century like nobody's business. Organic progress. Through the category of history, though, we in the 19th century, especially with the thought of Hegel, began to think of progress as a historical matter, not a substantial matter. We're not growing in virtue or wisdom, we're growing in history to ever greater illumination. The theory of evolution as well is contemporary with Newman, but also not surprising that Newman begins to think through his essay about doctrinal development on the analogy of physical growth. He avoids the analogy of historical growth. He avoids the Hegelian progressive view of development, and he prefers the scientific. Why? Because he's a natural Aristotelian. He's going to look at how things develop from the ground up. And that gives him an advantage over his 19th century progressive peers. He looks to physical growth, and as we'll see, he looks to physical growth as a model for how you should understand history. That history should evolve or develop or be understood to be moving in the same way that we see a tree move, develop from an acorn to its telos. That we should think about history in no other way than we think about nature. And this is a very clever way of actually moving people towards a teleological understanding of the universe. This organic understanding helps him to avoid materialism, skepticism, historicism, and to also give a powerful account of the unity of Catholic faith. With that background in mind, let's turn to the essay itself, where he proposes this analogy of understanding the faith on the analogy of physical growth, and he gives 7 notes for testing good growth from corrupt development. Right? How do you, if you look at a tree and you say, well, yeah, that's healthy development. That tree's developing in a healthy way. If branches are dead, then you know that there's some corruption. And it's these 7 notes, or sometimes he calls them tests, which tests whether or not development is true development or false development. Now, this is interesting in itself, too, because it moves 19th century discussions around organic growth, development, not around if you can change things, change them, but is it true change or false change? Is it change which is in accord with its natural principles, or in terms of the faith, its supernatural principles, or is it in conflict with it? Permit me one digression and then we'll get to the seven notes. You get someone like Father James Martin who wants to propose a change to church teaching, but it is not an organic change, right? It's a change which entails a repudiation of what Catholics have believed always, everywhere, and in all places, with the same meaning, with the same dogma. That is evidence. Well, Newman will say that is evidence of the corruption. That's a development that is corruption. But progressives, Catholic progressives, will stand up and they'll jump up and down for doctrinal development. But what they almost always mean is doctrinal corruption. Almost always. And so they're really anti-Newman despite their using the word. Okay, now we know what the stakes are. Early in the essay, he insists on the distinction between pure and corrupt. Pure and corrupt. Because he can clearly see this in the early church disputes. This is what all the early church disputes on. Is this pure doctrine? Is it handing on the faith? Or is it a corruption? Semi-Arian. He highlights the disciplini arcanum, like the guarding of the secret. That is the tradition that the sacred deposit was received completely and fully by the apostles and then mystagogically guarded. Plato thinks this too, that you have to mystagogically guard the secrets. And this is a great tradition in Western civilization. But keeping the secret is something which is given to the apostles who pass on but don't fully or completely publicly articulate the faith, even though it was handed on to them. What we might call oral tradition, that they are guardians of the oral tradition, which is superior to the written tradition, right? Just as the church is superior to the Bible, right? It composes the Bible. It's the guardian of the Bible. And so, they are always guardians of what is implicit over what is implicit, over what is explicit in the teaching. From this, Newman takes the providentialist point that time is necessary then for all the faithful throughout human history to come to understand the fullness of the divine deposit. That the faithful have to come and mature through their understanding over time. As he writes, this may be called the theory of doctrinal development. That's the first time he uses the phrase. This may be called the theory of doctrinal development. Now, I stress, he says theory, okay? Catholics have dogmas, not theories, right? There is no dogma of doctrinal development. You are not obligated to believe in the theory of doctrinal development. It is a theory, but it's a good theory. It's a theory which helps us to understand how we would test whether or not a development is actually a natural development, like an acorn becoming a tree, or it's a corruption, right? Like a man becoming a woman. In the first chapter, Newman writes that development means an increase in understanding an idea. This is very important to him. An increase in your understanding of an idea. The problem is not one of change, but the perfective standard for changes. This is where he says to live is to change, to be perfect is to change often. So the real problem is not change per se for Newman. This is his engagement with his times. The real problem is corruption. And how do you determine purity versus corruption? A false or unfaithful development is not an increase in understanding, but is taking you away from the object that your mind is meant to see. To test whether or not a development is true or corrupt, he produces these seven notes, and he outlines them in chapter 5. And I've given you a handout, and you can write your notes in the headlines here. But these are the seven notes, and you can test them against all of your Protestant friends to see if all of their closely held doctrines meet the seven tests of Newman. He begins chapter 5 with his desire to draw out a positive argument, he writes, for proving the intimate connection, or rather oneness, with primitive apostolic teaching. As he looks backwards from the 18th and 17th to the 16th century, back to the 5th century, back to the 3rd century, all the way back to the 1st century, he sees the continuation of what he calls one religious system, what he'll call a unity of type as well, one religious system. He is in awe of unity. He's in awe of Catholic unity. And he raises the question, the only question that can be raised is whether the said Catholic faith and now held is logically as well as historically the representative of the ancient faith. He maintains that it is, that modern Catholicism is nothing else but simply the legitimate growth and complement, the natural and necessary development of the doctrine of the early church, and that the divine authority is included in the very divinity of Christianity, he writes, end quote. That places us not in some sort of Hegelian dialectic, but squarely on the notion of legitimate natural growth of the same substance, that is purely on teleological grounds, on a natural analogy. Having become convinced of this much, he pushes on the analogy of physical growth again and how it helps us to think about fidelity and corruption. Corruption breaks up physical life. Think of death and decay. It begins to disintegrate, right? The integrity of a body disintegrates when there is some corruption, death, decay introduced into it. On the other hand, when life is working and flourishing, there is an integrative principle. Things are working together. Disintegration of parts versus the integration of parts into an organic whole. These are the images that he keeps in mind, natural images. Corruptions break up wholes. They divide. They take us away from fidelity. These are the watchwords. Corruption reverses and undoes what went before, he writes. Losing touch with its laws, its distinctive traits, its vigor, and its power of assimilation and self-repair. This is what happens as you lose touch with nature. He says we can discriminate healthy developments of an idea from its state of corruption or decay. And then he states all seven notes in a single sentence before delineating them. He says, there is no corruption. This is the summary of all seven notes in one sentence, if you want to write it down. There is no corruption if it retains one and the same type. That's your first preservation of type. Principles and organization. If its beginnings anticipate its subsequent phases, that's your second continuity of principles. And its later phenomena protect and subserve its earlier phases. If it has a power of assimilation and revival, you see number three, and a vigorous action from first to last. Now, that sentence includes all the notes in pairs. One and two concern preserving type and principle. Three and four concern assimilation and logical coherence. Five and six include concern to anticipate the future and conservative action upon the past. And then the seventh note is this test of chronic vigor, which is so important to him. Okay, I'm going to go through each and elucidate, and then we can discuss these seven tests. What is preservation of type, and what does he mean by it? The first test, he says, birds don't grow into fishes. Children do not grow into beasts. Acorns do not become dragonflies. And frogs do not become princes, except in fairy tales. Doctrine follows the same law that natural bodies follow, he writes. A nature develops in accord with its proportions, with its own natural inclinations, while remaining identically what it was. In the womb, you had a tiny arm. As a youth, it grew exponentially. And as an adult, it can perform a myriad of functions, from baseball to brain surgery. But it remains the same arm that it was in your mother's womb. It's not a different thing. This is true of other things, like a parish priest, a judge, a college professor, or indeed a college, a monastery. An office or a rule is the same even if a particular priest is corrupt, he writes. Indeed, corruption in an office is intelligible only because we know the essential function. It's a very Augustinian point that the corruption actually shows you what the good is that's prior. Because you could only have a concept of corruption if you had a concept, an idea of the prior good which is growing or being corrupted. Newman is after unity of type. What makes something one? What gives it its unity? This is a question in the 19th century, especially with ideas of evolution, when one thing can become another thing. This is like knowing what a thing is, a metaphysical question, and knowing what a thing is allows you to discriminate how it remains what it is, even under great changes in outward appearance. A nation, England, for example, a great nation like England, faithful to the Pope, is the same nation as an infidel England, not faithful to the Pope. We can say that one state of affairs was better than the other, but we cannot say, he writes, that England ceased to be a nation. An apostate nation remains the same type of thing. But sometimes even a small outward change in an and you've altered the type. John Henry Newman gives an example of Rome changing from a republic to an empire. That is not preservation of type in his view, because you've changed the nature of the thing. When you change the nature of the thing, you have had a real alteration. And that real alteration of the nature of the thing should be called a corruption. Whereas preservation of type is something we can say that the Catholic Church has always been the same thing. Principles carry on their potency to fullness. Secondly, continuity of principles. The second note says that the regulating power of doctrinal development is in the form. What does he mean by that? The regulating power is in the form. It's in the law or the principles of the thing which gave birth to the thing. The regulating power is always intrinsic in the nature of its origins. And what may be the law or principle that the doctrines embody from the beginning can be tested out over time. What may appear as a doctrine in one area may become a principle in another, he writes. Doctrines are like definitions of principles. This is him writing before he becomes a Catholic. Principles are the generative seed of doctrines. And the test is to see the principles through the doctrinal developments. Put differently, principles are the formal operation which makes developments in doctrine legitimate and genuine rather than corrupt. To preserve its type, the Church must preserve her principles. Elsewhere, he outlines that the principles must be continuous. You can imagine how they're, for example, the doctrine of purgatory, right, is not an early doctrine but a medieval doctrine. But the principle of praying for the dead is in the Old Testament. Right? And the principle of praying for the dead is part of the witness of the first century martyrs. So the principle is praying for the dead. Right? That's the principle which animates the medieval doctrine of purgatory. And so it has unity, it's a preservation of type, and it also is continuity of principles. And so when you're looking at doctrinal development, you actually have to look at the underlying principles which bring about the articulation of a doctrine. Okay. Those are first two. Power of assimilation. The Church must have the power to absorb the world. A Protestant theologian might say Scripture has the power to absorb the world. But the power of assimilation, Newman recognizes, is the Church's power to assimilate. The power to incorporate without things from without, without ceasing to be who she is, right? So the Church can incorporate things from a culture. Like if anybody's been to the Basilica of the National Shrine in D.C., it has Marian shrines where Marian apparitions have occurred all over the world. So there's national shrines. That's where the Church has assimilated the culture and life and customs and mores and history even of different nations and have consecrated those nations to the Blessed Mother. That's assimilative power. We can go anywhere and we can assimilate. We can assimilate Hillsdale. And he regards this as something like proof for the divinity of the Church. The fact that the Church alone can do this, right? Empires can sort of do this for a limited number of years, sort of. But the Church does this in a powerful way. And it's akin to God uniting human nature to himself, he says. It's almost something incarnational, like we're actually living through an elongation of the incarnation. where God can unite human nature to himself without ceasing to be himself, without ceasing to be God. So the church can unite various aspects without ceasing to be the church. So the church must be able to absorb the world while preserving type. And this is proof that the church is the whole, of which all the other things can be made part. It is the only whole. Every other whole is a kind of false whole, false universal. Fourthly, logical sequence. In retrospect, development is, he writes, logical, not illogical. Things make sense. You say, well, in the Old Testament, they prayed for the dead, and in the first century, martyrs also prayed for the dead. And then in the medieval period, they developed this doctrine of purgatory, and it makes sense. In retrospect, a posteriori, a good Thomist and Aristotelian will know, you think a posteriori, after the fact, a rule reflecting on history, it makes sense. But it is not something in which you look forward-looking. It's a logical sequence in retrospect. If the developments don't have a logical sequence and coherence to them, guess what? Probably corruption, right? Really important test. If there's not a logical sequence and coherence, you should call them corruptions. If you're moving from marriages between one man and one woman to marriage is between whomever, consenting adults, you clearly don't have a logical sequence. You have a break, right? Luther's insistence on private judgment, in Newman's view, was a departure or corruption looked at in relationship to Catholicism. I don't think anybody could argue otherwise, right? That is a move away from the church's own understanding of authority. Luther's insistence on private judgment fails the test of logical sequence. It is a genuine break. But it also becomes a principle in itself which rises to the level of logical developments, which you could say are further corruptions, so that you can move from the error around, or the corruption around private judgment to pietism, to liberalism, can I say that here, to pantheism, so that corruptions can work on their own logic too. Like, the heretical developments are a real thing for Newman. He thinks heresies can have their own kind of logical development, but they're incompatible with orthodox developments. There are liberals who are actually plotting, in Ross Douthat's words, to change the church. But to change the church is, in a sense, to get Newman's understanding of development backwards. Newman thinks development can never be anticipated. You can never anticipate a future development. You can only see the logical sequence in reverse, looking backwards. It cannot be planned in advance. It can only be judged as authentic or corrupt by examining its logical sequence. This is also another reason why you should be patient with the church statement sometimes. If a church statement doesn't make sense, well, maybe actually in retrospect it will look more coherent, or it will look less coherent and fall by the wayside. But that's what has to be determined over a period of time. Logical sequence is something which takes time. So the note here is that a doctrine professed in its mature years is likely to be a true development. This is why the dogma of Mary's Immaculate Conception, for example, was held by the faithful for many, many centuries before it was promulgated. That's true development, not a corruption in proportion as it seems to the logical issue, he writes. The fifth note is anticipation of its future, and then we only have two after this, and then you can skewer me. What can you anticipate in the future? Now, this is a note that sounds prospective, but Newman, ever the conservative, is actually good at making things sound prospective and progressive and developmental while preserving conservative principles. Anticipation of the future does not mean projecting development. I'll give a personal example. When I was a little boy, my grandmother would call me the professor. Now, this was probably an insult on some level to my grandmother. She had no idea or no inkling that I would actually become a professor. None. Not whatsoever. Was not in her universe of possibilities. It was just a term of teasing or endearment or maybe provoking her occasionally precocious grandson. But in retrospect, it seems like a prophecy. I indeed did become a professor, and that does seem like an anticipation of the future. John Henry Newman's example is better. Third Academy skeptics like Carneades claimed they were continuous with Socrates. Why? They claimed so on the tenuous grounds that he used irony against the skeptics. So the story goes that they must have continuity with Socrates because Socrates used irony. But this fails the test because it's not just a sufficient anticipation if they could have shown that he had deliberate doubts about first principles concerning God or morality. They could claim true development. This can happen with heresies too. Paul of Samosata, he writes, can have errors which anticipate Nestorianism, or Berengar can state errors about the Eucharist that anticipate the errors of Zwingli, but they don't know it in advance, right? It can happen with orthodoxy. Augustine can state claims about the intermediate state, as he does in the City of God, intermediate state between death and resurrection, which do anticipate medieval doctrines of limbo and purgatory. But he has no idea, right? This is actually to the credit of a development, right? That someone is proposing something that cannot be anticipated but fits with a future development. So this note is that definite anticipation at an earlier period in the history of an idea to which it belongs is actually evidence of faithful development, right? So if Augustine says Mary and sin can never be mentioned in the same sentence, that is an anticipation of the future dogma of the Immaculate Conception, right? Sixth, conservative action upon the past. This is a kind of rule of fulfillment in a different direction. Regarding the law, Jesus said he came not to destroy but to fulfill. This is the idea that true development always conserves something from the past. You probably have heard Catholics talk about that Catholicism is a faith which never subtracts but always adds. That's this idea. We always add. We don't subtract from the faith. He came not to destroy but to fulfill. True development conserves everything from the past. It never loses what it had, but it always gains what it had not, he writes beautifully. True development, then, is always positive. It always adds without subtracting. This is why you can't say, well, the church taught this about church-state relations in the 19th century, but now it teaches something completely different. That doesn't pass the test at all, at all. Okay, councils are a good example of this. There are some who wrongly view every council as superseding the prior one. That is not the Catholic view. The Vatican II is not one ring to rule them all, right? It just isn't. It's an important council. Historians of Vatican II tend to think this way, I think, sometimes, that Vatican II is the one council to rule them all, that it somehow negates the Council of Trent or Vatican I, God forbid. And these are corruptions in Newman's view. These are corrupt ideas. The councils are cumulative, and they're tending towards the same ends, and they're coming from the same origins. At its heart, you could say Pope Benedict's hermeneutic of continuity, or rather his hermeneutic of rupture, is identifying what Newman would call corruption. True development conserves antecedent developments and adds to them, bringing out treasures old and new. This note ensures that all additions must illustrate the past, must show logical sequence, must show preservation of type. Developments which fail to do this, obviously, should be regarded skeptically. True development bears the mark of Catholicity, he writes, and the unity of truths across time. Newman writes, a developed doctrine which reverses the course of development which has preceded it is no development, but a corruption. If the doctrine of Christ's hypostatic union were itself developed,
so as to say that the two natures were indistinguishable in their personal union, that would in fact be a corruption, or indeed a heresy.
And so we get to the crux of it, that discerning corruption is no different than discerning heresy.
This is indeed the sixth test of true development, the tendency to conserve and not reverse what has gone before it. Finally, seven. I think the most important note. The seventh and final note,
maybe the note that goes back to when he's 14 and 15 and then to when he converts,
is chronic vigor. As he puts it, the course of heresies is always short compared to true development. It feels long to us. If you go through 70 years of the Arian controversy, it seems like, well, that's a man's whole life, right? But that, in the long scheme of things, he says, is short. Those disruptions in the church are corruptions that produce error and decadence, and then the church comes back from that with vigor, with chronic vigor. Newman says, corruption always leads to decline, but that's good news, right? A corruption will lead to decline, which will lead to death, which will lead to the need for a revival of chronic vigor. And this is, in a sense, what Catholicism has that no other faith has, is chronic vigor. True development leads to vigor. And the reason why it leads to vigor is because it has the divine life-giving energy. It's very almost Eastern in its stress on energia. Arianism, Nestorianism, monophysitist communions were certainly kept together for a time, but they lacked the chronic vigor. They lacked that energy, and they die out. Maybe they'll come back in some other form. Maybe the Manichaeans will die out, and then later we'll see the Albigensians. But it's always short-lived. Rather, the real test of true development is the unity which it gives to Catholic life. Does it give unity? Does it build up the faithful? Does it attract vocations? Does it draw people to the faith? Does it convert families and nations? If it does those things, it has chronic vigor, and it's the real thing. This is what you want, to determine true developments as part of a living unity, like the acorn becoming a tree, having chronic vigor, fortitude, tenacity. These are the words he uses. Staying power, perseverance, you might say. Christianity is like fire that doesn't go out. It exceeds all historical circumstances. And this is at the point at which Newman says it's all true. So to summarize, Newman's seven notes are really about discerning the unity and identity of the idea of Christianity. Through its development through time, Newman is taking history seriously. He's taking history seriously as a proof for the unchanging truth of Catholicism. Newman turns questions about truth and change into a practical, intellectual apologetic for the faith. He says the seven notes can really be counted as one and the same. What are they doing? All seven notes are to guarantee substantial unity. Semper idem. Okay, let me just say one more thing about semper idem, and then we can have questions. Newman's essay, I hinted at this before, is a theory. It is not the church's teaching, even though it has been referred in church document to church documents. It is not a doctrine. We don't have a doctrine of doctrinal development. We don't have a dogma of doctrinal development, for sure. It's a theory, and it's a very helpful theory. But it's a helpful theory in precisely the way that precisely the opposite way that people tend to use it. People tend to speak about doctrinal development in all the ways that Newman calls corruption. You tend to think about doctrinal development in terms of how do we change the church. So Newman's a very, very good Trojan horse. He said, well, dear friend, let's talk about doctrinal development with Newman, because he helps us to think precisely what great reactionaries at Vatican II, like Joseph Fenton and Cardinal Ottaviani, thought, which is that there's no such thing as doctrinal development. There is theories of good and bad ways of understanding the logical sequence of the continuity and substantial unity of the faith. But we needn't regard it as more than a theory. We needn't regard it as magisterial to understand and learn from its usefulness. The presumption for both Ottaviani and Newman is that the church's teaching is not constantly changing because truth doesn't change. It is always staying the same because at the center of Catholicism, the source of its chronic vigor and fire is Jesus Christ, who is the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. And Newman shows us a path for understanding how to be one with him. Thank you. Whatever you like.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.